On behalf of the General Studies Committee, I'd like to welcome all of you to the second in our person-to-person series. The next event in this series will take place on November 16th when Robert Williams of the Flag Studies Committee will talk. For those of you who aren't familiar with the format here, our idea is to have several of the celebrities on the Washington University campus come and introduce themselves, their ideas, and their work to the campus community in an informal setting with opportunity for questions and, after the more formal part of the program, conversation, give and take. An introduction of a speaker always encroaches on his time and, in the present case, would also preempt his topic. So, without further ado, Professor William Gass.
My typewriter rests on a great oak plank between two sawhorses. In the old days, when the first volume of Vines and Memorial Porches had appeared, and I was, in a manner of speaking, famous, I had been pictured in the colored pages of a national weekly working on Trumpet to the Dawn, then shortly to follow Hearst's House as the middle of my masterpiece, and a thumping success, it turned out. Shirtless, the hair on my back, which was bleached by the sun, making quite an effect in Kodachrome, puffing at a cigarette, a bluish string of testimonial smoke wreathing my clenched eyes, hands descending roughly toward the keys, face screwed with the effort of creation and my nails trimmed, rope belt tightly cinched and tied as a pirate would with a looping bow above the hip. I was vain in those days. God. It cut into my waist and raised, or rather, while indenting the skin, seemed to raise, nevertheless, a wheel which reproduced itself in the photo as an irregular pale splotch contiguous with the top of my tan shorts. Not a bit flattering. And as I remember, I wore clogs and had my legs spread straight as sticks, as I have since seen pregnant women spread them when they dared. And my desk in that photo was just such a desk as this, exactly the one my knees are under now, as a matter of fact. For I felt obliged by the picture to use it sometimes, though I don't wear a rag when I write, but work naked and compose by staring at my cock and balls. And that sense of obligation, the sight of myself in the picture, put me under it so often that I began to compare my wooden horses to the feathered dray pulls of the Phaedrus. The right-hand horse, a stallion, graceful as a skipping girl, blonde and clear-eyed, yet thick-maned and large like the lion, with a lion's deep throat and tubular teeth, swift and tireless, moreover, as a coasting bird, as far-sighted, patient, and implacable, with a regal neck which I lifted at every sound like a deer's, and with wings to satisfy an angel glowing from their passage through the air. While the left, oh dear, the left, a shambling, drunken mare with a cropped tail and a coarse, shaggy coat made of hairs with darkened ends, sore-footed, foul-mouthed, fattish and knobby, with short, uneven legs and a snub face and white-webbed eyes, nervous, shy, her inner organs cruelly eaten by disease, given to rhythmic swaying like a bear, inclined to bite, her dwarfed wings so closely folded to her side she never flew at all, but fell as crudely as a stone, as brutally as eager. And as I say, this obligation sent me back and back again until sitting to the trestle became automatic, necessary even when bitter, as now. It was a track so deeply worn. And I can reach with a pencil end the words I have carved in the wood by tracing them 100,000 times. My doodles, too, always the same, cutting a canyon like a stream, dark at the bottom with graphite, beautifully smooth. For graphite is a handsome lubricant. In beautifully turned calligraphy, cunt, for instance, with many curlicues. Here's something funny. I had begun that particular tracing first, so it was rather permanently down when I began the final volume, and it really happened that on the day I composed its most famous scene, that tender lover's parting on the porch of Mount Lyon, Parker kissing the tines of Carol's parasol. Anything sounds absurd when outlined simply, and there's a lesson for us all in that. Then folding it abruptly as a sign that he's leaving the mount forever. While I was composing this tender, sentimental scene, I say, restlessly stirring my words around and wondering how I should manage the business, my pencil was continuously, thoughtlessly, idly tracing Kunt still more darkly in the oak, imparting a rhythm to my hand and arms, rocking my shoulder, affecting what? My brain? Which reminds me of the technique of Madame Bovary and of Flaubert's startled whore, cigar ash on her belly, formal hat on him, the supremely cool equestrian. Well, in another word, covenant, which was the name of an historic oak beneath whose boughs a treaty depriving some Indians of land in return, I believe, for their enjoyment of an interlude of peace, was signed by some Quakers and those Indians with an X. And when the oak, having fallen prey to drought, wind, age, or some disease, I wonder, was it the same disease as mine, was cut down, bands played doubtless, there were solemn speeches in rented hats from wooden stands, while pennants snapped in the rhetorical wind. A long heart slice was sent to me, though God knows why. I hate both covenants and trees, and this accounts for the incision of covenant, and for fuck the Indians, hurrah, a bordering phrase, etched small. So I am an inveterate pencil carver, and I consequently understand the qualities of wood. I know how, for instance, the grain will cause the most determined line to quake and wriggle. My first attempt to engrave the letter C in the covenant plank left a very bent and shaken L, though you would never guess it now, the original is so overlaid with flourishes. The secret is to proceed by a series of gentle scratches, repeated often, never an impatient deep gouge, which the wood will surely put a crick in, but always the patiently light scratch. A painted surface is tricky. Oh, it's easy enough to make pencil marks on a fine enamel, but that's not the aim, you know. Get under the skin, that's the idea. So you must watch that the paint doesn't flake, or you will spoil the clarity and decision of your line. I'm not much interested in images myself. I always carve letters or abstract designs, five pointed stars sometimes, the capital L, which in script curls its edges like a sheet of stamps, or F or K, or the word Isabel, or thickety black scrawls bunched like tumbleweeds, and mazes of dizzily turning lines like the spill and flow of hair. Whole worlds, really, the track deepening as you journey on, as if at any moment you might penetrate something, find yourself inside the wood, say, or simply, like Alice, land thump in another part of the soul where a voice is exclaiming, my, 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 as you arrive, and there is a vague flash of white from something running or a pink glow from the lobe of an animal's ear or the faint but steady ringing of a distant alarm. Then frequently, balloon. Traveling, I've returned to stations where I've stopped for gas and found my stars still there, sometimes even darkened or deepened by those who love as I do to slip into a path and feel the rhythm of another mind, a stranger's, once sitting where you are, tracing some secret of his life on the wall or in the toilet seat, not always cheap or vulgar either, for after all, it is the form and not the content that matters, though there are those who scratch haphazardly, concerned to get their filthy message over, in art and life the same. But they aren't everybody, thank God, for I've seen the masculine member drawn by a genius, and a vagina rendered strangely like a daisy. And once, as high as you could reach, like the bragging claw marks of a bear, exquisitely formed, the word lemonade. By a divinity. That's a passage from a piece called The Clairvoyant. And I suppose if you care to see me, I am in that passage somewhere, perhaps more completely than I am anywhere else, here, for instance. Most of what a writer says about himself and the world is a pack of lies. And what I want to talk about this evening mostly is how, if you happened to be interested in finding out what the author of a work is of literature is like, you go about doing it and the kinds of traps which can be set for you. Why, that is to say, even when a writer is busy telling you about himself, what he's telling you is probably a pack of lies. It's the form which the lies take which constitutes the truth. Now, I can't speak to you this evening as a novelist or a short story writer or a critic. You can hardly call yourself a novelist when you have amassed one small novel. A handful of stories does not allow you to credit yourself as a short story writer. And a book of criticism, which is largely book reviews, hardly merits the name of criticism. What I think I probably am more interested in doing, in terms of what I have in fact done, as I look back and examine it at any rate, is writing. That is to say, I am more interested in writing than in writing novels. I'm more interested in writing than in writing essays or short stories or whatever it may be. It is the writing itself, the actual process, I think, which interests me more than any specific form the writing may take. Consequently, I've always been rather interested in the theory of writing and the relationship which theories may have with actual practice, and how theories themselves are acts of subterfuge and deception behind which the writer hides. Now, we all use language every day, so that as a consequence, we tend to look on writers, I think, a little differently than we look on musicians, or composers, for example, or sculptors, painters. And I think that this kind of thing can be exceedingly misleading, for we may tend to assume, after using our language to call for another beer, or order someone out of the house, or yell fire, or whatever it may be, that we're using language in much the same way as the writer uses it. Though if we were putting a coat of paint on the barn, we might not suppose that, although our talents differed, we and Picasso were engaged in fundamentally the same occupation. I think this is one of the things that leads people to suppose that behind the words which a writer uses, you can find the writer in much the same way that behind your own words when you're writing a letter to somebody or when you're speaking to someone about something, you can find the author and the person. And I want to stress, first of all, the fact that whenever a writer begins to write, even indeed when he begins to speak, there is immediately the intervention between himself and his listeners, and indeed between himself and his subject, between himself and himself, the intervention of the medium. And it is the medium, I think, which begins to make its own demands on the writer, begins to resist what he initially may have wished to say, begins to impose its own personality, so that what you have very frequently, as you sit down, for example, to write a letter to a friend, and suddenly you find yourself spending more time formulating what you were going to say than actually saying it to your friend,
The words have intervened. They have become your friend, and you're carrying on a dialogue with them. So I want to talk initially about the kind of scruples, the kind of difficulties, the kind of changes that occur as a consequence of being face to face with the medium and being obliged to respond to it rather than to the things which the medium may presumably be a sign of. Now, I suppose that when writers write, there are roughly, say, three kinds of motives, at least that I want to talk about, they may have. Two of these motives are irrelevant totally, it seems to me, to the literary quality of the work. However, it takes only a noble, saint-like writer to be so pure that every word he writes is conceived by him only and entirely for its literary quality and doesn't carry any of the other things with it. Well, one of the things that your writing may do for you is, in the popular sense, express yourself. And language, of course, gets in the way of expression. A howl of rage is very expressive. As soon as you begin, of course, to think about what tones your howl should take, whether it is syntactically correct, it gets in the way of howling considerably. It begins to interfere. Now, why should you be bothered in the first place? Howling is much more, as I say, effective. It's effective. But the trouble with exclamations which may express your inner state is that they are comparatively crude, undifferentiated, and after a while, people will simply let you howl and hope after time you'll go to sleep. The language gets immediately in the way of the expression of this cry. And so there constantly is an obstacle between what increasingly is building up as your inner nature, full of these feelings, these secret thoughts, and so on, which nobody in the world ever has had before, and which you must rush, of course, to let people know about, things of that sort. It is a state, I think, that most people go through very much in adolescence. And what we want to do is not just release our feelings or release our thoughts, which we can do that in a number of ways, but we want to be able to release thoughts which, first of all, are negative in such a way that people will accept them. We want to be able to say dirty things, think naughty thoughts, have emotions which are otherwise disapproved of, but present them to the world in such a way everybody says, aha, how brilliant, or how wonderful of you to have had such a thought, or something of the sort. It's not merely, of course, to get the world to accept your feelings, but it's also, and even perhaps more important, to get you to. Because by the time you finally get them out there, everybody sees them all wrapped up for Christmas, you may be able to accept those feelings in yourself much more readily. What I want to emphasize, first of all, however, is that probably your disreputable feelings started as nothing more than disreputable feelings, just plain nasty. By the time, however, they have been formulated, they're changed. So that the actual act of formulating your emotions, your thoughts, and so on in a certain way changes your nature, changes your thoughts. Now, some of these are negative, and therefore not acceptable. Hate, for example. In my case, I suppose the most predominant negative feeling involved in my writing is resentment. And the idea is to make this, in a sense, acceptable. But there are positive feelings, too, which we cannot go about simply larding on the world, however positive we may think they are, because they may be positive, but their expression is still not acceptable. I mean, try complimenting a lady as she passes in the street in her hot pants on the curves of her bottom and see. You may have this lovely feeling of appreciation for a work of art, and so on, but you know, you can't express it.